Both an art and a science, valuations are complex things and their impact is enormous, making the difference between generational wealth creation and a comfortable retirement. At Bizval, we know how tough it is to grow and run a business, which is exactly why we've made valuations simpler. Whether you are using our online tool Bizval Live or reaching out to us for a concierge offering, where we spend more time on your numbers and your business and give you detailed feedback, you can be sure that the same techniques being used by professional investors are also being used by us. And with Bizval Bootcamp, we will prepare you for those discussions with investors. Welcome to the Bizval podcast. This is going to be an incredibly interesting one across rather hectic time zones. My name is the Finance Ghost, coming to you from Cape Town as usual. My guest today, coming to us all the way from Florida, so this should be pretty interesting. His name is Ted Leverett and he goes by the name the Original Business Buyer Advocate, which is very, very interesting. So you've spent more than 30 years, Ted, just helping people worldwide find and buy the right businesses. And I think you've been involved in all those sort of elements of acquisitions, from preparation and target searching all the way through to due diligence, you know, valuations, negotiations, all the kind of stuff that, guess what, Bizval is also involved in, you know, down here and for an increasingly global audience. So it's really nice to be able to chat to you. Maybe we'll do some work together in future. Any time will tell, I suppose. And I think you've written a couple of books on Amazon and maybe you could chat about those as part of the podcast, but it's just great to have you on. Thank you for making the time in a busy schedule. I don't know if you want to share your claim to fame about where you live that you shared with me before we got on the podcast, but I did think that was quite fun.
My claim to fame? Are you talking about where I live?
Yes, yes. Who you ride your bicycle past? I just think it's quite a fun story.
Okay, here we go. I ride my bicycle a few miles away by President Donald Trump's house.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, well, certainly ex-president, possibly future president. I mean, who knows? We won't guess what will happen with politics, that's for sure. I think America is one of the few countries in the world that has politics that are more juicy than South Africa, actually. So between the two of us, we definitely live in interesting countries.
Oh boy, you can say that again.
So Ted, I think today's podcast, we're going to chat through a mixture of some sell side and some buy side, just concepts, I suppose. And before we do that, just for the listeners to understand, this is very much investment banking speak, but basically sell side means from the perspective of the person with the asset that is being bought, the company. Buy side means from the perspective of the investor sitting on the cash. And they actually have very different needs, right? At the end of the day, and actually diametrically opposed desires in a transaction. There's a very natural conflict of interest. If I pay you too much for your business, you win and I lose. So Ted, if you start, before we get into some of the detail, just historically you've worked with both sides or do you specialize in one?
I mostly work with buyers. I've worked with sellers earlier in my career and now sellers contact me basically when they want me to tell them how buyers will view their business and then I'm done with them. But with buyers, I take them all the way through their search to a done deal.
That's super, super interesting. So I can tell you in the South African context, the sell side mandates are seen as the ones you really want to have. It's actually easier to find the money than it is to find the asset down here. I'm not sure if it's the case up in the US. The US is such a big, liquid, exciting place. There's so much going on. I sometimes read with no shortage of jealousy all the activity in that market. But that's very interesting. And I can understand the value you bring to a sell side, you know, client base of understanding how investors think. That's a really great skill.
You know, with respect to the ease of getting transactions, here it is very easy because we're a massive country with massive population and a massive quantity of businesses. When we do searches here, we can identify wonderful businesses within a month. When I help people in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, other places, no, it takes a lot longer because smaller population, usually more distance between towns and fewer opportunities. It just takes longer.
Just thinking now of you helping clients in Australia, some of your calls must be on two separate calendar days for some of those clients.
There are. One of the guys who follows me the closest and I've been able to trade lots of ideas with him when he did his first deal, he used to get up at 3 a.m. Australian time to tune into the stuff I was doing here in the USA.
Incredible. Yeah, global business is not a joke, is it?
No.
So Ted, I think let's start tapping your mind because there's really a lot of insights that I think you're able to share with us. And obviously this podcast does have a little bit of a time limit to make it practical for our listeners to enjoy. And we're going to start with the sell side. So first question is, you know, we always hear about how businesses are generally quite difficult to sell. Founders struggle to find a buyer. That is generally the story that comes back from the market. In your experience, is that the case? Are businesses difficult to sell? And what is it that holds founders back from having a more successful exit?
I want to preview what I'm going to say throughout this conversation. What I'm going to say, just about everybody listening, including you, you're going to say, oh, I know that. It is self-evident, but guess what? Most of the time, the mistakes that the buyers and the sellers make, they're errors of omission. Not making mistakes, other than they omit doing what they should do. And sometimes they just don't know they should. So if you're thinking as we're going along, oh, I already know that, we'll just make a note that you remember it in the heat of battle. Okay, so what hinders the sellers? Themselves, the owners. They're responsible mostly for what goes wrong. And they're also responsible for what goes right. And the reason is these sellers, well, they trip over themselves. They falsely think that what they're doing is the right thing, and it's not. And of course, that's really good on my side when I work for buyers. Some of the things that, other than the sellers themselves, that go wrong, or let's say hinder, dependency, the business too dependent upon the owner. I advise buyers not even to look at businesses that are owner dependent. Another one is emotional. For most people who own businesses, it's their baby. It's their legacy. In fact, it's their identity. So it's tough for them to even think about selling. And sometimes because they're in love with the business, even when they want to sell it, there are barriers that they create. Another one is their motivation. Guess what? They're going to have to be more motivated to sell than buyers are motivated to buy. We'll talk more about that later. I have another note on that one. Most sellers don't prepare right, or they don't prepare at all. They think it's like selling a house or a car. The kind of preparation that these sellers are messing up is they think they're supposed to prepare their business for sale. Guess what? That was not where to begin. They should have started preparing themselves. We just talked about a few things, emotional, financial, etc. Because when it comes to negotiation, guess what? Companies don't speak. Owners do. The other thing, I made a few notes. Well, you hear exit planning is on LinkedIn and all the social media. Yeah, you need to have an exit plan. If you don't, you're going to sell on the buyer's terms. That's simple. The biggest tip, though, I think I want to give on this topic is most owners do not nourish a friendly relationship with buyers. They absolutely have to be likable. And I say to buyers, if you're not likable, there are plenty of other buyers out there. Because remember, the owner's selling the baby. Oh, I guess the other thing, last thing is, pricing. Most owners overprice their businesses. And after the market slaps them around a little bit, if they want to sell it, well, they'll accept what a buyer is going to pay.
Yeah, Ted, that's such a great answer. And there's so much in there. It sounds exactly like so many of the conversations we have with Bizwell clients. And it's stuff that people don't want to hear. But unfortunately, it's true. I mean, my identity is the finance ghost, that business that I'm involved in. You know, Bizwell is my one baby, definitely, and the finance ghost is the other. And Bizwell is a business, and the finance ghost is just glorified self-employment, and I know that. I mean, it's literally my persona. It's sort of my pseudonym through which I write and do podcasts and have a bit of fun. It's as owner-dependent as the day is long, you know, even though it's a pseudonym. And people just don't want to hear it, that they actually have a self-employment opportunity that they are trying to sell as a business. And it comes through in things like not adjusting for what they should be taking as a salary. You know, they forget. They think, oh, but this business pays me. So I'll use a Rand example, and you can laugh at it in your very strong dollars. But you know, this business pays me R1 million a year. You know, it's not a lot of dollars. This is a great business. You should buy it. Well, why would I, you know, buy the right to pay myself a market related salary? Or what am I doing here? I could just carry on working. So it's all these sort of concepts that are just lost. And I think you've touched on so many really good points. I think the thing that I love the most there was, you know, if you don't have the exit strategy, you're going to sell on the buyer's terms. That is so succinctly put. That's exactly right. You are not going to get a successful exit. You might exit, but it's not going to be what you could have had. So I think moving on, Ted, to the next question is, you know, just the difference between a financial and a strategic investor. So, you know, we all have this conversation every single time we value a business. And that is basically, we value it on the basis of a financial investor. And we always say to people, a strategic investor might phone you and you can hope they do, but You know, as the old saying goes, hope is not a strategy. So from your perspective, the difference between a financial and a strategic investor, the way that eventual offer actually differs, I'd love to hear your views on this.
You know, in my world, I almost never work for strategic buyers, and you'll see why when I finish this explanation. I work for financial buyers. Those are private parties generally. So first I'll cover the differences. That's your first part of your question. And then I'll talk about how their offers might be different. These strategic buyers, well, they're rarely individuals. They're basically companies. And the thing that makes them different is they're willing to pay a lot more than some people think businesses are worth. In fact, a lot more than what we'll call the financial or the private party buyers are willing to pay. And it's because these strategic buyers are going to get access to things that fit in, usually, to what they already own, like another company. And the other thing that I find different, actually everybody sees different, is the strategic buyers tend to hold for longer terms, maybe the long run. Whereas the financial buyers, being private parties, they're looking for something they can run. These are people who generally do not hire managers. Some do, but most don't. And particularly first-time buyers need to be careful, because if they don't know enough about the business, how are they going to hire the right manager? Private equity firms, they're frequently financial buyers because, and in their case, they do hire management. The financial buyers, I guess they're really looking at return on investment. They want a good income. They want a wage. And they want to get their money back. They don't want to lose their money. Whereas strategic buyers, they tend to be open to many different kinds of businesses. Whereas these financial buyers, the private parties, if they're smart, they stay on their resume. They try to, at least for their first acquisition, find and buy businesses that fit what they've been doing or what they know, or that they could very easily learn. And we can talk about that more later. The other thing is the financial buyers, the private parties, most of them say, I'm going to keep it forever. But actually, what they'll do is keep it 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years. I find in America that a lot of business owners sell their businesses on the schedule they sell their houses. And in the USA, other than what the pandemic did, houses used to trade about every 7 years. And guess what? Businesses were somewhat trading in that time. Remember, these are the small and mid-sized businesses. Okay, now the other thing you want to know is the purchase offers, how the purchase offers would differ. Well, pricing. Strategic buyers are known to pay more. Why? Because they can get more value. And why? Well, synergy. They're putting what they're buying into something they already have or they control. The financial buyers, what they're focusing on are multiples of profit or multiples of seller discretionary earnings. In America, there are plenty of databases that show you what companies have sold for and the multiple and some of the other terms, and we're able to compare. And the private party buyer is looking at the multiples. Strategic buyers, they care, but who cares if they overpay by 10% if it dramatically increases their market share or their profit from the other things they own? So that's a big one. I put time on it. The other one is what's different is financing. Strategic, lots of resources. They can trade stock, shares, cash. They can get loans. They can get investors. Whereas the financial buyers, guess what? They make a down payment and they go get a bank loan. And if they can't get a bank loan, well, maybe then they go to asset lenders and investors. But good luck on that, because if the business can't get a bank loan, you have to wonder twice whether it'd be a asset. Well, asset lenders have assets, but how about investors? I mean, who wants to invest in a company if the company couldn't even be bankable from day one? The other thing that is different in the purchase offers is there's a section where the seller agrees to stay on for a while. Strategic buyers don't care too much about that because they're already in the business where they have teams that are able to come in and hold everything together. And so maybe a thank you, good night over a weekend to an exiting owner. Financial buyers, private parties, they have to go to bed with that seller. In the USA, it's anywhere from, I'll say 30 days because you'll read it online. But if you're my client or you're smart or experienced, you're getting 90 days to 6 months with the seller working in the business at the beginning, then phasing out, because there are all kinds of things that require eyeballs and hands with the seller and the buyer together, like relationships with the customers and employees. And just one more thing, because I saw it in some notes you sent me, earnouts. Again, strategic buyers don't worry about earnouts, because even if the business doesn't perform as well as the seller says it will, the strategic buyer has other reasons to buy. financial buyers, they like earnouts, or at least they hope to get an earnout, because otherwise they'd have to overpay or write a blank check for a business that they don't think is as good as the seller says. Spoiler alert, in the United States, despite what you read online, it's sellers are not going to want to get an earnout. Their lawyer doesn't like it. Nobody likes it. So unless you have a highly motivated seller, good luck on getting an earnout, you financial buyers. That's it.
I just love how different the markets are, right? So the thought of a 90-day handover, I can tell you now, South African sellers can only dream of a 90-day handover. I've never seen that. I've never, ever seen that. I suppose it depends on the size of the business. Probably the market standard here, if you're selling a decent size operation, the kind you're talking about, no owner dependence, like decent size business, decent size buyer, 3 years earnouts, pretty standard, as in you still need to be working there for those 3 years, not you get to just run away. I mean, it does depend on the level of owner dependence, but even where you've got these typical family sort of led businesses that sell into listed companies, public companies, there's still those sort of earnout provisions, those handover periods. I mean, even on the smaller stuff, a year. It's fascinating to me that there can be a 30-day handover and that's considered a handover. I mean, yeah, that is like an immediate exit. That's incredible. No, that's unheard of. You know, you blink and you're gone. So that is, yeah, I love the differences between the two markets. It's very, very interesting.
Now, you know, the one area that I really ought to put a baseline here, I don't get involved with online businesses, e-commerce, SaaS, none of that stuff. My world are brick and mortar businesses, retailers, rarely retailers, manufacturing, wholesale, construction, companies where there's a physical premise where employees go to work or maybe work remotely and they buy or sell products to either businesses or consumers.
Yeah, I get it. I kind of picked that up when you spoke about, you know, why would you want to buy a business that's not bankable, which is another great comment. So again, just to give you some context, you know, life in South Africa, banks here are worse than useless at funding entrepreneurs. They just hate taking the risk. And I'm not sure if it's because we are a relatively low growth, high risk economy and they can't really, the debt returns are not really worth it in their world. I don't know what it is. You know, people scratch their heads around it a lot, but they're just really bad at it. They'd much rather just lend to, you know, typical borrowers for houses and cars or limited stuff, you know, asset-based lending, but sort of term loans into businesses. It's really, 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 really difficult. So it's also really difficult to go and raise debt to acquire a business here. And that makes for a far more illiquid market than you would have in the US, definitely. Just these structural differences, right, between the two businesses. It's amazing how it plays out. I think moving on to the next question, Ted. So just the one piece of advice you would give a founder who is thinking about selling. I think you've already touched on some really important stuff, but is there that one thing that you would say is more important than anything else?
I won't explain it, but there are four things. They're just about equal. Motivation, why you want to buy or sell. The right advisory team, if they're not deal makers, good luck. Number three, price it to sell it if you want to sell. And guess what? Here's what most sellers don't do right. They don't market it to sell it.
I have to ask you to elaborate on that last point, on the marketing to sell it.
I kind of thought you would. Business brokers and others are helpful for sellers, but you know what? There's lipstick on a pig. Even a broker might have trouble selling it. And where sellers get it wrong from the get-go is they don't realize that their financial records, that is their number one marketing piece, because the first question a buyer asks, remember, no buyer shows up unless they already know it's for sale or think it's for sale or might be for sale. So they've looked into the business and said, gee, I'd like to own one of those. So the very first thing they say is, show me the money. Well, if those financial records are not accurate, they're not up to date, they're not well organized, and if they're not promptly presented in a readable and usable format to the buyer, you just blew marketing effort number one if you're a seller. The other thing the sellers do is they don't pitch the value proposition and the company's competitive advantages in the ways that, well, buyers understand. You know, Warren Buffett, you know, famous guy, he says the most important thing to him are sustainable competitive advantages. Most owners say, okay, there's our financial records. We're a good company. You're going to love it. It's not enough. So you got to be able to explain it in a marketing way. The other thing is detractors, We talked about owner dependency, not good. The other thing is concentration of customers and suppliers. It's all about marketing. If somebody thinks that one person makes everything happen in the company, everything important, not good. And if there's too much concentration of a customer or supplier, that means that if a buyer comes in, a customer or a supplier could hold that whole company hostage if they don't get their way. And of course, the other thing, again, marketing to sell it, confidentiality. A lot of owners don't protect it enough. Now, I work the buyer side, and I am amazed at what sellers tell us they don't need to tell us. And I'm also amazed they do give us that information, but they don't do it in a way that protects themselves. It's not that my clients would misuse it, but they better get better advice before being so open. And the other thing is, I said it earlier about marketing. Business brokers, or whatever you want to call these people around the world, intermediaries who work for sellers. On my website, I have something called 62 Reasons Why Sellers Hire Brokers. 62 Reasons Why Sellers Hire Brokers. You ought to look at that, because if you're an owner wanting to sell, that means market it. You better be able to do those 62 things. Because if you can't, everyone you can't do is a buyer advantage. By the way, one more time, I work for buyers and we like those advantages.
That's a really fun and really good answer. And again, it's so much of the stuff that we work with, you know, because we work with the sellers. So it's really nice to actually test that, you know, even on the other side of the very big pond, things are not so different. So that's good to see. I think, Ted, let's move to the buy side. We're about halfway through the show, maybe a bit more. And, you know, first question straight up, because now this is your client base, right? What is the appeal for an investor to go and buy what is called an SMB there, I think, small and medium business? We call it small and medium enterprises in South Africa. SME is the common term. I can tell you your idea of small is very different to our idea of small once you convert in dollars, but be that as it may. What is the appeal for investors of those SMBs as opposed to just going, you know, buying stocks in Google or in Apple or any other public company?
Everything I'm talking about today reflects my world. I do work for buyers and sellers who are expecting to pay or get anywhere from $1 million to $10 million in price. That's my world. I don't work on what we call mom and pop or main street businesses like hair salons, etc. In other words, if you drive by it on a main street, I'm not in that world. That's too little. That's buying a job. That's not my clientele. Anything bigger than 10 million price, then we have to compete with private equity. And that's not good because these private individuals, well, they just basically cannot unless they got deep pockets and are willing to pay more than private equity. Now, as for publicly traded, I don't think I've had once in my life, decades, anybody say to me, hey, Ted, I'm trying to figure out what to do with this extra few $100,000 or $1 million. I think I'm trying to decide whether I should invest in another publicly traded company or go buy a business. It's never happened. Why? Because if you want to control your life, control your income, you don't hand it over to some publicly traded company. I mean, you just don't. And so in my world, people want to have direct control and influence. They have zero interest in publicly traded shares. It doesn't mean they don't have stocks and bonds, because they do. That's where their money has been until they take it out to go buy a business.
Yep, that's a great answer. Very similar again down here. I love the similarities. So let's see how similar the next answer is to our experience down here in South Africa. So these are your views now on buying a controlling stake in a company versus a significant non-controlling stake. What do you advise your buyers to do? What are they typically comfortable with? Is it kind of control or nothing? Or do they take what we call minority stakes down here? I'm not sure what the correct term would be up there.
Well, there's a third variation. There's controlling stake, there's non-controlling stake, and then there's owning it all. My clients mostly want to own it all. Why? Because if you have I don't care if you call it a partner, investor, yeah, anyone. Banks, you might not think about it, but they have a big stake, and it may not be controlling like you think it is, but miss a payment or violate one of the conditions of the loan, and you'll find out how controlling they are. So my advice is buy a business you can afford to buy 100% of it. I had a client in England 2 years ago, for example, could have done a deal, could have paid cash for a deal. But what we decided was keeping the owner on in an ownership capacity and buying part of the business now with an owner who absolutely wanted to leave, but not today. We cut him in on what would be a better deal later for everybody if he stayed and helped this buyer, who now had controlling interest, take the company forward. So that's an exception. But it's not easy to find those kind of sellers that are going to be good enough to give them a controlling stake. I'm not going to say this later, but I might. Have you ever known too many partnerships where people were delighted or the partnership survived?
Not a hell of a lot. I mean, I've had some good ones and some bad ones. I'm very lucky that the ones I'm in now are very good and maybe some lessons learned from previous ones, and may they stay that way. Touch wood. Normally edit out those noises from podcasts, but I'll leave that one in so people know I touched wood. Don't know if, is that a saying in the US? Do people touch wood as like a joke to say, you know, I just want that to be true? Or did I just do a South African thing?
No, that's pretty common.
Okay, there we go. All right. Well, there we go. Another similarity.
We call it wishful thinking.
Yes. Well, yeah, that too. Well, hopefully wishful thinking in this case pans out. But I mean, you're right. So I use this example with an entrepreneur the other day who was asking about bringing in a shareholder into the business for like 5% of the shares. I said, you know, that is like literally agreeing to let your in-laws, you know, bless them, move into your spare room for the rest of your life. They're not going to contribute much to the house, but you're going to know they're there all the time. And it's a lot like that. It really is. It is like that. As soon as you allow other shareholders, especially when they're not playing a role in managing the business every day or strategically driving it, it's a guest in your spare room all the time who's going to share your space with you. And that's not great forever. So I think, Ted, let's move on to my third question on the buy side here, which is your buyers, do they tend to be specialists in specific sectors? You know, do you get people who walk in and say, I am only interested in buying this type of business? Or they're a little bit more flexible because they are generally financial buyers. They're just looking for good returns versus the risk involved.
Well, the people who are listening to this that know me, now you're going to hear what you don't like. So this is a good time to keep listening because it could be some more. But when you hear the word from a searcher, someone who wants to buy a business, hey, and by the way, these are not business buyers. They're searchers. They're not buyers till they do a deal. So what do these searchers do that makes them perpetual searchers until they run out of money? They say, I'm agnostic. I'll buy anything you show me. But what does that say to the other side of the table? Well, it says that you're going to be a tire kicker or peeking through windows. You really don't know what you want. I mean, it's just so many dumb reasons to say you would buy anything. It's just like going to the airport without a ticket and saying to the family, okay, we're here, we're packed, where do we go? It's going to come down to risk tolerance. That's what I tell my clients. And you want to look for businesses in sectors that when you walk in, you have some familiarity. The farther you get from what you know, including your network and other people you can bring in to help, the higher the risk. Remember, I like to work with the individual buyers. The individual buyers, it's all about credibility. Remember, while the seller's trying to sell a business to a buyer, the buyer has to sell the buyer's personality and capability, money, to what? The owner. So to be credible, it's a good idea when you're talking to an owner or a broker to say, I'm looking for a metal fabrication company or something very closely related, instead of saying, well, you know, manufacturing would be pretty keen and so would maybe retail and maybe even a bed and breakfast. You know, it really does come down to risk. It just really does come down to the risk. The farther you get away from what you know, the higher the risk. So why bother if you can find a wonderful business that fits?
Yeah, again, sound advice, can't fault that at all. So interestingly enough, a lot of South African businesses have gotten that wrong. So because a lot of South African businesses are really big and their market is quite saturated, then they look for opportunities offshore. And then they assume that they understand that specific market, or they go and buy something that is a little bit different to what they do down here, and they get hurt. They get really, really hurt because the market's different. And this is a listed company with all of the resources available to them, and it's still that difficult. So I think sticking to something you understand and know, sound approach, I would say. Maybe that leads quite nicely into the next question, actually, which is our second last one. And that is, you know, just roughly speaking, the proportion of buyers in your experience who actually really want to get their hands dirty at management level, maybe it is a business that they know, versus those who are just saying, you know, I'm a bit more of a silent partner. I want to come and buy this thing, but I'm going to just keep relying on the management already there to keep running the show.
Have you heard the term suffering in silence?
Yes, that has made it to South Africa.
Okay. I tell my clients, don't even think about it. Don't even think about it, because you're going to get involved if you make an investment in a business, whether you think you're silent or not, because all businesses have bumps and grinds and things that don't go right. And if you have money in a business, you are going to pipe up the first time you hear about it, but you have zero control. So keep in mind, if you're thinking about being a buyer, you want to be active. You want to be able to shape it. You want to control it. You don't want somebody else to tell you what to do. The best buyers are the hands-on managers, at least for acquisition number one, a hands-on manager. That way you can say to bankers and the next deals you do, I put my hands on a business. When it changed hands, I steered it. It's successful. And that's why I have more money to do the next deal. So align those skills. These silent partners, on the other hand, really the only resort they have maybe is litigation. Well, besides whining. Oh, I'm going to be a consultant on the advisory board. Whoever controls the company doesn't have to pay any attention. And it doesn't mean they're trying to cheat you. It just may mean they're too stupid to know they should pay attention to you. So I'm very negative about silent or minority interests. I'm also very negative on people who think they're going to buy a business that runs itself. You know, that's also BS. That's my story on that topic.
Yeah, I love that answer. I mean, again, it's my spare room analogy, right? It's you know, the silent partner, this person's going to just stay in the spare room and never have an opinion on what's on the television or what happens in the kitchen or whatever the case may be. It's not going to happen, but if they're paying the rent for just one room, they have no say anyway. They're just going to get annoyed by it and not actually be able to do anything about it. So again, these things are, you know, I tend to agree with you. I think if you want these relatively silent stakes, you know, the thing runs itself, go and apply your mind to researching listed stocks. Make that your hobby rather, you know, because that's what those things are. You don't have a say. You know, you absolutely don't. The difference there is if you don't like what's going on, at least you can sell it. You just press a button. If you don't like what's going on in a private company, you're stuck. You are absolutely stuck.
Absolutely. Could not agree more.
Last question, Ted, on this really, really cool podcast, which I've massively enjoyed. The one piece of advice that you would give one of your prospective investors, again, well, you've probably got four based on the sell side version of this question, but hit me with the most important advice just as a nice wrap up. For buyers of businesses.
Okay, guess what? I wrote a book. It's called How to Buy the Right Business the Right Way. It's on Amazon. Why? Why did I write the book? Because some people don't want to spend money for people like me. They're do-it-yourselfers. Well, at least read the right kinds of stuff. You need to learn about searching before you hit the playing field. You need to learn about buying before you talk to an owner or a seller. It's just that simple. Keep in mind, folks, buyers, sellers and brokers, lenders and advisors are not tolerant. They don't like ill-informed and ill-advised searchers. In other words, if you're ignorant, nobody wants to know you. The other thing you better learn if you're a buyer, if you want to buy the right business the right way, is you better learn how to avoid your buyer competition or beat it. In America, it's huge. We have websites out there and endless online forums where people are all looking to buy businesses and they're sharing ideas. Guess what? That's buyer competition. You don't want to walk into a business for sale and have five other buyers next to you, unless you like to what? Outbid the dumbest one. When it comes to price, you got to price the business that you can afford. Quit looking at stuff too small or too big. In due diligence, you better have the right team, because I've never met a buyer who could handle due diligence correctly for everything. So you need to have a team, and just bring them in when you need them. You don't have to give them blank checks. The other thing, you see it, I see it all the time, cultural. White-collar executive buys a company that employs blue-collar workers and sells to blue-collar customers. Well, you show up in a suit and tie and everybody else is wearing, in Florida, flip-flops and shorts, or in New York, overalls. It's not going to fit. You're not going to get along. And if you have a spouse or a significant other, that person's not going to go to the country club if you're that white collar guy and say, hey, we own this really cool automobile paint shop. Give me a break. Don't forget the legal. Don't forget the transition. If you don't get the transition right with the seller, you can, within a few days or weeks, wreck a wonderful company. And that's my story.
Ted, thank you. It's been a very, very entertaining conversation. Tons of insight. I guess I'm just really pleased that so many of these insights do travel so well. You know, it's really nice to know that the career built in South Africa actually does have some global relevance, because a lot of these things are the same in the US. So thank you so much for your time. And what I'll do is in the podcast blurb, we'll make sure we include the link to your books on Amazon for those who do want to go and read a bit more and get some insight into the US market. I think that's super valuable. Thank you. I know you're on LinkedIn. So if anyone, you know, is listening to, well, a lot of people from your network might be listening to this, people in South Africa who might be interested in the US, reach out to Ted on LinkedIn, have a chat. And Ted, just thanks for making time. It's been a really enjoyable show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And good luck out there.